Hey folks, I bet you never thought you'd hear this show again. It's been a while since the podcast ended, but in the last few months I've quietly been working on what I consider to be the next chapter in the evolution for this show. Earlier this year, I began hearing from people that wanted the podcast to continue. At first, I really didn't feel it. I'd walked away and moved on to covering other cases for Vanished alongside my co-host for that show, Jennifer Taylor. But something strange started happening. That itch that I'd lost started to return. At the same time, I started researching new theories in this now 85-year-old case, and I soon discovered that if we were going to do this, now would be the perfect time. The podcast has returned in a limited series to once again take up the chase with new theories, new guests, and shocking revelations. We've also taken the legacy of Amelia Earhart to a whole new level. Tonight, it all begins again. Welcome back to the world's only dedicated podcast to the life, legacy, and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. Hey, Bob, welcome back. Thanks for doing this, sir.
You're more than welcome.
So we were talking offline just now, and I mentioned this to you, obviously, then. Tonight's a very special night because I'm a big fan of anniversaries, and we have a good one to celebrate because it's 10 years ago this year that you released Amelia Earhart Betrayed. So happy birthday to that book and happy book anniversary to you, sir.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
A lot has changed since then.
A lot has changed since then, I'm sure. And we'll get into it. We'll try to get into as much as we can tonight. For those who may not know, for those who didn't listen to our original interview way back when and they know who they are, tell everyone who will be listening to this a little about your background and what you bring to the case expertise-wise.
My background is I was a helicopter pilot, mostly in the military for 40 years, from 66 until I retired in 2005. Flown basically all over the world, Vietnam, Saudi Arabia, Central America, the United States, blah, blah, blah. I have been retired since 2005, wrote a book in 2012, which we released.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, a lot has changed since then about my ideas as far as what went on. But
yeah, let's talk about the book. Why did you write the book? I mean, I don't think I've ever asked you that just directly. Why did you write the book?
When I was on my way to Vietnam in November of 67, we went over by ship and I had two books with me, which I read on the way. One was Fred Goyner's book, A Search for Amelia Earhart, and a book called Iron Men and Wooden Wings about the First World War aviation. I became very fascinated with Amelia Earhart because all I had heard about before then was that she crashed in the ocean someplace and sank, and that was it. Fred Goyner put a whole new light on the entire thing. Made me quite curious, and I've been curious since November of 1967 about what happened to Amelia Earhart. And it comes and goes.
Yeah, boy, does it ever. It's been several years now since we sat down officially for the show. You were early in our run. Tell me, you touched on it earlier, and I know it's a very broad question, I know it's a very dense question, but tell me how your viewpoint differs now in comparison to that original interview and when you wrote the book.
It's not that I don't know more. I know a lot more now. I guess as a person gets older, they find out how much they don't know. I was fairly certain back then in 2012 about what happened. I had my own ideas, and I pretty much ascribed to the Japanese capture theory, but I was also open to the other ones, especially Gillespie.
Yeah.
To this day, I can't tell you what I do believe. Actually, I'm not a real fan of any of the theories as they stand.
Okay.
I think they need to be modified.
Well, we'll get into that modification in just a bit. I think that's compelling. Okay. Well, I guess on that note, how important is it in cases like these ones to be able to objectively look at evidence and not add your own confirmation bias in to fill in the gaps? Is that difficult to do?
It is for any investigation. And it's one of the things that you have to watch on a constant basis. It sneaks in to your thinking, mm-hmm. Confirmation bias does. I noticed that almost all the theories to date ascribe to the fact that Amelia Earhart was doing exactly what she said she was doing.
Right.
I believe that almost every theory that we have so far, the confirmation bias is there. All of their decisions are made with that in mind. She was rigidly adhering to the route that she said she was adhering to, and she got lost and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
I don't believe that anymore. I personally don't believe that Amelia was doing what she said she was doing.
If you had to pick a major difference between your line of thinking when you wrote Amelia Earhart Betrayed and your line of thinking now, what would you point out that's different now?
I've become, I think, more open-minded. It's a very difficult thing with all of the eyewitness testimony about the Japanese capture theory. It's very difficult to just set that aside, although you have to. You have to be able to set that completely aside and say that may have been somebody else. It's like you pointed out on your trial. I'm probably about 25 or 30% through your book. I'm just coming up onto the trial stage.
That's okay. That's okay. Take your time.
I don't believe that right now I ascribe to the Japanese capture theory as it is presented.
Okay.
Although there are certain aspects of it that are hard to deny, i.e. the picture that Les Kenny came out with.
Yeah.
They did a very, very good show. The picture was very compelling.
Yeah.
And then some guy, I don't know what his name was, a blogger in Japan, comes up and says, oh no, that came out of a 1935 book. Mm-hmm. Instantly at that point, everything that those individuals had done to that point, were it's gone. It's all blah, blah, garbage. And Amelia Earhart becomes toxic. I think the History Channel had a perfect opportunity to investigate the guy that came up with the picture, where the picture came from. When did the United States government get that picture?
Right.
Nobody has ever said anything about that. And there's never been an investigation. They wrapped it up. They never showed it again that I know of ever. And it was almost like somebody said something bad about the CEO of the network's mother. It was just gone.
Yeah.
It was swept under the rug. Not fair to Les Kenny, not fair at all to the people that were involved.
Absolutely.
If you look at the picture, it's compelling. It had to, first of all, it wasn't made in 1935 because the pier was rebuilt in 1936. So we know it didn't occur in 1935. So we know that something has to be wrong with where it was found.
Yeah.
But nobody ever investigated it. Something that happens a lot with the investigation. Somebody comes up with one single tiny little thing and says, oh, no. And everybody believes them and goes another way.
Yeah. Well, on that note, let me just ask you, I guess, an even broader question. Does this case have a evidence problem?
Yes, they do. They even have evidence problem for crash and sink. How many airplane disasters have there been when not a single thing ever washed ashore on any shore to deal with that airplane in the last 85 years?
Yeah.
Nothing. So there's even an evidence problem with crash and sink.
Yeah.
And crash and sink, of course, has more than just evidence problems. It has a logic problem. If the aircraft ran out of fuel, it was a pontoon boat. It would have floated. It had five tanks that would have been filled with air. They're sealed tanks.
Yeah.
How long is it going to float? Where is it going to float? Don't know, but it's going to float. And anything that floats is going to end up washing up someplace.
Yeah.
But it never has. So crash and sink has its problems too.
If I were to give you just a blanket statement and say, it's my opinion that Amelia Earhart was indeed a spy, how do you react to that opinion?
I say she was. That's probably the only thing that I'm pretty certain of, because it would have been a ridiculously missed opportunity by the government at that time to gain some unbelievably good intelligence that they really needed. And she even told, now this is also hearsay, but she supposedly told Mark Walker that she was going on another mission other than the one that was advertised, that was written down in a diary, supposedly, although I've never seen the diary, but it was written down that she said that. And she also said that she had an aircraft that was capable of 250 miles an hour, which at 10,000 feet altitude, full bore, it is.
Yeah.
247, I believe. She had the capability. She had a capability that nobody knew about at the time. But she said it herself. She also said, she made a statement publicly that said if she didn't find or couldn't find Howland Island, that she would go back to the Gilberts.
Is that on record somewhere?
Oh, yeah. She said it to a reporter. She said it to a reporter before she ever left. The reporter asked her, what are you going to do if you can't find Howland Island? And she said, we'll go back to the Gilberts.
I feel like that would be a massive piece of evidence that would favor Japanese capture, because if she's actually saying this is plan B, I feel like that's pretty damning piece of evidence in favor of Japanese capture for sure, if that's out there on record.
Yes, it is. I'll try to find it for you. I picked it up someplace. It's in the book, and I will try to find it for you and give you that piece of information, because it is quite important. First of all, she wasn't a stupid woman.
Right.
There was no stretch. She was an excellent pilot, too.
Agreed.
She would not have gone on the mission that she was going on without an alternate plan if things didn't go right. People don't drive to work without some kind of alternate plan if something goes wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So why would you go 2,256 miles?
That's right.
Over open ocean without a second plan? I don't think so. I say that the Japanese capture theory, I have a hard time putting it down. I don't put it down. I think very possibly that she was a guest of the Japanese for a time.
Mm-hmm.
Some people say, well, that's impossible because the Japanese would have admitted it by now. The Japanese don't admit anything that happened during the war.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, they're getting to the point now where they actually will admit that they were involved in the war.
Yeah.
But they said, well, the JN-25 code was cracked and so on and so forth. So it would have been in there, but that's not true.
Mm.
The Admiral's code, the Japanese Admiral's code, super secret. If you had possession of probably one of the most famous people in the world that belonged to a country that you were not entirely happy with and who wasn't entirely happy with you, would you broadcast that on a code that basically any Tom, Dick, or Harry with a security clearance could listen to? Or would you put it out over a super secret method that to this date has not been cracked? Has not one message in the Japanese Admiral Code been read? Not one.
Wow.
There's the evidence. If somebody wants to go in and ask the Japanese, hey, do you have the key to your Admiral's Code? And do you have a list of the messages? I'm sure that somewhere the U.S. has the messages because we collected all those messages. We decoded the ones that we could and left the ones that we couldn't. But the ones that we couldn't, if they were in the Admiral's Code, you might have a nice little message to say, we got Amelia Earhart here at such and such a place. And what do we do with her?
Yeah.
They're not going to do that on their own. Some general, some one-star general in Jalu or any place is not going to make a decision about what to do with basically Elvis Presley, right? Mm. I mean, with a rock star. Mm-hmm. They're not going to make that decision for themselves. Show me an admiral. I don't even think Admiral Nimitz would have made that decision at the time without consulting at least the president.
Yeah.
What do we do with her?
Jesus.
It's there. If it happened, it's there. But we just don't have access to it.
Oh, Jesus. All right. Well, let's switch directions a little bit. Since we last spoke, there's been a lot of new activity in this case. There will be a lot more new activity in this case, I think, in the coming months and in the coming year. What do you think the injection of new theory does to a case like this? New ideas, conceptually?
I think, first of all, it brings interest, if nothing more than people doing their level best to try to disprove the theory.
Mm-hmm.
What we have here is a whole bunch of separate entities that have their theories, and their answer, instead of proving their own theory, is to torpedo somebody else's.
Yeah.
That seems to be the going way to do things. If it isn't torpedoed by the theorists, you have to look at what might have been torpedoed by the Japanese.
Mm.
They have an interest. Or what might have been torpedoed by the Americans, because they have an interest also. I mean, FDR, if she was on a spy mission, he basically hung her out to dry. Would we want that out?
Mm.
It goes back to a time that's different from today. I've heard the statement made so many times, well, anything about that would have already been declassified.
Mm-hmm.
That was in a day when the president would call somebody into his office and say, I want this done. And then they would say, okay. And they would go out and get it done without any paperwork, no super secret documents, no top secret stuff. Because back then, the accountability was different than it is today. Everybody has to perform the old CYA. Everybody has to have something that they can deny. I didn't do this, or I did this the way I was supposed to do it. Back then, people just did things. Somebody from ONI very easily could have gone to the president's office. He said, look, I want pictures of truck. That guy's job would again been to get pictures of truck.
Yeah.
And also, he would have done it without a lot of things in writing. There wasn't email. He's not going to send it through the mail. He's going to do it face to face. He's probably not going to talk about it over the phone. So there is no record to uncover some spectacular, hello, there it is.
Yeah.
It's all in writing.
Right.
It won't be.
Right.
The one thing that nails people today in government that try to shred and burn paperwork about things that they don't want known, the thing that nails them is a little organization, another three-letter organization, but this one's called the GAO, the Government Accounting Office. Those guys have exposed more secrets because you don't spend a dollar of federal money unless you have a piece of paper to show where you spent it and why. Operation MK Ultra, that guy, the head of the CIA, burned all the paperwork, shredded all the paperwork, was all gone. Congress investigated it, put together an idea of exactly what happened through testimony. But then like 4 years later, 22,000 pages of figures showed up about MK Ultra from the GAO.
Yeah.
Proving everything that Congress had put together through testimony. That was now.
Right.
We're not talking about now. We're talking about then. Then it was a lot different because there was a slush fund. The president had a slush fund. A slush fund then was a real slush fund.
Yeah.
He could do with it whatever he wanted.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of new, I want to give you an option to talk about Buka. It's the elephant in the room. You and I have certainly discussed this offline ad nauseum at this point. You've spoken with Bill. You're familiar with what he's hypothesizing occurred.
Yes.
Tell me why it works. Tell me why it doesn't.
Well, okay. Bill got a hold of some bad information, i.e. the weight of the aircraft and several other things. His theory about how she or why she turned back doesn't work because the numbers don't work. She took off with the 950 gallons of fuel. Yes, she did. She took off with 950 imperial gallons of fuel, which is 1150 gallons, U.S. gallons, okay? He took the description in the book, Mary Lovell. She quoted the newspaper article about the takeoff, the sea spray and so on and so forth, about how it was a really difficult takeoff. Amelia Earhart herself said she was going to take off with 15,000 pounds. That's what she was going to weigh, 15,000 pounds when she took off. She said that at the same party where she said the 950 gallons of fuel. But the aircraft only weighs 7,265 pounds empty weight. That includes the oil in the engine. So it takes off at almost 15,000 pounds with everything on board and the fuel. There was no running low on fuel, was not the problem.
Okay.
But let's face it, Bill has an airplane. Nobody else has an airplane. Nobody, right?
Yeah.
So you have to say, okay, Bill, if that doesn't work, if what you say as far as why she went back there doesn't work, which is what people use to destroy his theory or try to destroy his theory. Mm-hmm. The only thing they haven't been able to get around is the fact that he has an airplane. Okay. You can't get around that. He has an airplane, period. And you got people like Robert Ballard, who took the trouble to go look at Gardner Island, Nicomororo, to see if, see if that airplane was there. He went to that trouble. What kind of trouble would it be for him to do the same thing at Buka? Obviously, he's not compelled to do that because everybody's saying, oh, no, that can't be. You have to come up with another reason, a plausible reason. Why was she at Buka? And if you come up with a plausible reason, which I have come up with a plausible reason.
Okay, let's hear it, Mr. Wheeler.
It's another theory. Okay.
inquiring minds would like to know. I'm sure people will be turning up their podcast audio at this point. Tell us.
Okay. My first question was, when I started looking at the whole thing, she was having radio problems.
Right.
Or we think she was having radio problems. And we've already established that she was not a stupid woman. Okay. Yeah. She knows that when she gets to the end of the line, 20 hours down the road, mm-hmm. she's going to have to be able to talk to somebody to get a DF steer to the island.
Yeah.
Because the island could be easily missed. It's what, 1 mile long and a half a mile wide?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
She's got radio problems, but she keeps right on trucking down the road, just like nothing happened.
Yeah.
Even though she can't talk to anybody, she just keeps right on going. Well, doesn't that seem a little strange? Ah, yes, it does. I ran some figures. She could have flown easily with a slight course change to Rabaul from Ley. It's 394 miles from Ley, New Guinea to Rabaul. Rabaul has fuel. They have aircraft facilities there. In fact, it's a larger operation, or it was a larger operation at the time, than Ley was. And they also had 100 octane fuel, which they didn't have at Ley. So she could have pumped up, topped off her tanks, all both of them, and she could have left Rabaul, almost 400 miles closer to Howland Island. She could have left there with a full tank of fuel and working radios, but she didn't, okay?
Yeah.
That obviously didn't occur to her. The difference, the difference was in the distance, 17 miles.
Mm.
That's how much the difference would have been between going to Rabaul and Howland as opposed to going straight to Howland, okay? So then you have to ask yourself, why? Why didn't she do that? Well, my contention is it's because she turned off her course well before that, about halfway between Ley and Rabaul. Mm. And she headed north. She headed north to Truk, which was her original mission. She goes to Truk. Okay. Her second position report, I'll have to read it. Okay.
Okay.
Her second position report says at 319 local, height 10,000 feet, position 150.7 east, 7.3 south, cumulus clouds, everything okay. All right.
Right.
That's what's it. Well, when you plot that course, it shows that she'd only gone a couple hundred miles from Ley. And everybody says that can't be right, because she couldn't possibly be there. Okay.
Right.
What did she do in the interim? Well, if you take that particular set of coordinates, 150.7 east and 7.3 south, if you change the 7.3 south to 7.3 north, 150.7 east and 7.3 north, you come up 75 miles southwest of Truk.
Jesus, don't tell me stuff like okay? that.
I'm sorry. I won't tell you that. She arrives there at 4:30 in the afternoon. A lot of people want to know, why did she wait until 10 o'clock in the morning to take off? Well, pictures have to be taken in a certain light.
Mm.
And the light at 4:30 in the afternoon, if you're headed east, the sun's behind you, everything is perfect for taking photographs. Okay?
I love when somebody presents a very practical explanation for a very complex question.
A simple answer.
A simple explanation?
Say simple.
Simple explanation. That's what we need, I think. Yeah, it makes sense.
All right. So then the next position report puts her nailed down directly on course where she's supposed to be. Okay.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, but that just smells like a lie to me. Okay. Especially if you don't have a visual.
Yeah.
So that was 2 hours later. 319 was the bogus one, 520 or 521. She slam on course. No problem at all. Everything's good to go. This is where Bill picked up that she was way behind schedule. She must have run into unforecast headwinds or so on and so forth, not realizing that Noonan is calculating headwinds constantly.
Mm-hmm.
He could tell you hour by hour what the headwinds are. That's not a problem. They fly over Truk, snap a bunch of pictures. They're at 10,000 feet. They're higher than they have been. There's nothing that could catch an aircraft doing 200 miles an hour at 10,000 feet that goes right over Truk Island. There's no airplane that the Japanese had at the time that could possibly have caught her.
Was that part of the plan? Were they banking on the technology behind the airplane and what it can do in flight to sort of aid in her being, sort of under the radar, so to speak?
Yeah, she had the ability to do that. She had the ability to do it. She had the need to do it. Everybody wanted her to do it. Everybody in the government did anyway, the Navy especially. Mm-hmm. They wanted to know what Truk was all about. So she flies over it. Then she does something. And we covered this in the book. She turns southeast and she heads for Nehru.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, Nehru is really a great thing because Nehru will, in the Pacific Ocean at night, when it's as dark as the inside of a cow, 300 or 400 miles out from Nehru, it's going to look like New York City because of the lights at Nehru. A blind person could find Nehru at night in the Pacific. All they have to do is get close.
Yeah.
Which we know Noonan had the ability to get close. So I plotted a route doing just that. She's going to Nehru. Now she gets north of Nehru. Now she doesn't want to fly over Nehru. The one thing that I think is just icing on the cake is ship in sight ahead. I think what she was doing was broadcasting to the world that she had just seen the ship that she was supposed to see, which was the Ontario,
right?
Which was her ship. That's about the time that she should have seen it, right? When in fact, at that particular time, she's about 300 miles or so north of Nehru, but there's no ship there. So she gets close to north of Nehru. She swings out around Ocean Island. There's a reason for that, because then when she comes back, takes a direct heading now for Bougainville.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, she doesn't need anybody to show her Bougainville. If she doesn't see Bougainville, it's because she's got her eyes closed, right?
Yeah.
If she doesn't hit Bougainville, she's going to hit a bunch of other islands too.
Right.
She's going to a large landmass. She doesn't need the radio for that.
Yeah.
There's no reason for that at all. So now she's around Ocean Island. She heads directly to Bougainville, to a place called Aropa, A-R-O-P-A.
Okay.
It's an airfield. It's a 5,400 foot, nice, flat grass runway. It was back then. It was just a grass strip back then. It was belonged to a plantation. I haven't been able to run down the name of the people that were involved with the plantation or not, but I would venture to say that that was her goal. She's headed for Aropa. She gets there. Now, here's another thing. When does she arrive at Aropa? She arrives at Aropa at 1933 Zulu.
Okay.
To give you a time frame here. Her last transmission was at 2000 Zulu. I'm saying 8 o'clock. I think it was a little bit after eight, but
yeah,
around 8 o'clock. She arrives there as close as I can figure. It depends on a lot, but anyway, 1933 Z. She arrives at Aropa, rather.
Right.
She can't find it because she's in the clouds, or she's on top of the clouds. She's probably in the clouds. Okay.
Right.
She can't see Aropa, although she knows she should be there. Time, distance, heading sort of thing. Pilot did. She knows she's so supposed to be there. Noonan knows she's supposed to be there.
Yeah.
And here's the thing that's really going to hurt. Okay. If you get to Aropa and you want to fly a Sunline 157337, if you want to fly that, guess where the northern thing takes you? To Buka. Buka is a 331 heading from Aropa. Her last transmission occurred approximately 6 minutes before they lost contact with her, or about 6 minutes before she would have arrived at Buka. All right.
Wow.
That's all theory.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
And if you want to back it up, okay, we go to, well, first of all, we go to a psychic. Good old Edgar Casey.
Yeah.
The man of the 1930s. Who called so many things, right?
Right.
What did he say about Amelia Earhart? George Palmer Putnam went to him. That's on record too. And asked him, where's my wife? Okay. He said that she crashed 97 miles northwest of, he said, Howland Island.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I read something a long time ago that said his original text was not Howland Island, but the original text was for her point of intended landing.
Yeah.
Okay? Everybody thought it was Howland Island, right?
Right.
But she's 97 miles northwest of there. okay? Mm-hmm. Guess what's 97 miles northwest of there?
What's 97 miles northwest of there?
An airplane sitting in a lagoon.
Interesting.
Just off the west coast, or it would be the east coast of Buka, in that general area. That's 97 miles. Now we're going to do another psychic, okay?
Okay.
We go to page 13 in the Purdue Archives.
Mm-hmm.
Message from 12 July of 1937.
Okay.
Unsigned, sent by a friend of hers who's a psychic. She's been contacted by Amelia, and it's dated Monday, July the 12th, 1937. And this is, of course, in the Purdue Archives. All right. Tell my sponsors I appreciate their efforts. Tell my husband I was there when he walked into our room. I wish that they would all look at this. That seems to be the unfortunate happening for them as a truly fortunate happening for me. I seem to be able to see things through a clearer vision than ever before. Strange yet beautifully real is this new life. Everywhere I go, I hear them say, "How did it happen?" It truly happened so quickly that I myself cannot tell you just how it did happen. Not for one moment did I lose consciousness. I know that we were hit by lightning. We were heading north again, and I believe that I might have made it, but then the ship was struck. I slowly went into the water. There's a great deal more I might say, but I feel it unnecessary in regards to Fred Noonan. We glided for some time. The storm became very bad, but I was not afraid because I sighted land or a small island. It took just three huge waves, and the next thing I knew, for a short period, I felt I had fallen asleep, blah, blah, blah. Okay.
Wow.
That's been on record since the 12th of July of 1937. Now, what did the little boy say to Bill?
The little boy said that he thought it was like the second coming of Christ. He said it seemed like they had been struck by lightning.
Mm-hmm. Actually, he said it came out of the clouds with a wing or the engine on fire.
On fire. That's right. Yeah. God damn.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, probably just didn't spring into fire by itself. It was in a thunderstorm. He said it was a horrible thunderstorm. Anyway.
Wow.
You see how easy it is to make a case? I can't prove any of that. I mean, I can show you things that I think are logical.
Yeah.
But as far as proof is concerned, that's going to have to be up to Bill, because I love Bill. I truly do. And I like his attitude. And I did an awful lot of work for him when we came up with Fred Noonan's DNA. I'm a fan of what he's doing. I just wish somebody else was too. Somebody with a lot more money than I've got.
Well, yeah, me too. I think that's going to be an interesting situation, what unfolds in Buka. I think he's, as I said, I publicly always state I'm a Bill Snavely fan. I have been since I met him the first time, and I will continue to be. And I think he's a brilliant man. And I think the world will see that too at some point. And I think it'll be very interesting to see what happens when they do. So I'm, for the record, a big Bill Snavely fan.
Me too. Now, as far as the Japanese capture theory is concerned, all right, we can't completely torpedo that, because Buka is a lot closer to Saipan than the Marshalls.
Yeah.
Okay. And there's a lot of people on Saipan that saw her, supposedly, and Fred. Anything that came from the aircraft could have easily been taken from Buka to Saipan, easily.
Let me just ask you something real quick. Bluntly, was the Japanese monitoring Earhart's position?
Oh, they had high-frequency direction-finding stations all over the Pacific Ocean. They probably knew closer to where she was than we did. But the elephant in the room here is, if in fact that was her plan, to go to Europa. My conjecture is that she was going to Europa and land, and she was going to sit tight for a few days.
Yeah.
She disappeared. Nobody knows where she is. So it gives the U.S. a chance to launch its search into the Marshalls and do its thing there.
Mm.
And then all of a sudden, she shows up. She flies her airplane to Rabaul, refuels, goes to Howland, and goes from there.
Right.
And she's accomplished her mission.
That's the original plan.
Yeah, I think that's the original plan. The problem is that when she disappeared for real, they had to have known approximately where she was. And they made absolutely no effort to go look.
Hence, Amelia Earhart betrayed.
Mm-hmm. I think that they knew that she was in that area, since that's where she was headed. But they held on to the public view of she's on Howland Island. So we're going to spend, what is it, $4 million they spent then for the search?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which amounts to what, like $40 or $50 million today?
Yeah.
They spent on a search that they knew would turn up nothing. And the Japanese told them, hey, stay out of the Marshalls. We'll look there ourselves. That didn't work. I've seen a lot of theories that say that she went to Truk, that the, one of the first ones that came out, she went to Truk, then she flew to the Marshalls.
Yeah.
And was down there. Well, why would she fly to the Marshalls? Because she's going to be there at night. She's at Truk at 4:30 in the afternoon. So the rest of her flight over Japanese territory is all going to be at night.
Yeah.
So you don't see a lot at night. They didn't then. Now, of course, it would be a different story, but then it's not. So
yeah.
Bill has a point with the radio calls. I think it's probably Skip. And she was actually talking to somebody on the ground at Europa, but you can't hear what Europa had to say. Nobody was listening to them, and you wouldn't be able to hear that anyplace else. Okay.
Yeah.
Because it was a ground station. So it was probably not really a very powerful radio on the ground at the time. I figure it belonged to a plantation owner. And I think if somebody ran it down, they would find out that that plantation owner had ties with the Australian government. It's a neat little plan.
Yeah.
I think it was probably a better plan than the one everybody thinks happened.
All right. I rarely do this, but I'd like to get your opinion on something that another guest said during our Japanese capture segment on season one of Vanished. He said, this is John Hagedorn, who runs another podcast, 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries. It's a really great podcast. But he says that if Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan did indeed die in Japanese capture, or in Japanese custody, I should say, prior to the United States involvement in World War II, then they would be the very first casualties of World War II, and they should be honored in that way. What do you make of a statement like that?
I think he's got a point. If she was spying, but spies don't get the public recognition that they should, okay? And the fact that her mission failed because nobody got the pictures, it was easy to deny. It was easy to stand back and say, well, we tried. We did our best.
Yeah.
Even though I feel quite certain that they knew approximately where she was. But the problem is they heard this broadcast on 3104. If she'd have been hit by lightning, guess what would have happened to the radios?
Yeah.
Boom. They're gone.
Immediately. Yeah.
A whole bunch of vacuum tubes blow up in the cockpit and under the seat.
Not a pretty sight.
It's a done deal. And an engine on fire. Okay. Let's go with that. My first contention was she should have gone to Rabaul, landed, and refueled anyway. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because one of the sayings in aviation that I learned in flight school was the only time you have too much fuel is when you're on fire. Okay. Otherwise, yeah, you cannot have too much fuel on board the aircraft. All right.
Right.
She's got another 4 or 5 hours of fuel on board. If her left engine, and I can almost guarantee you, somewhere I picked up that it was the left engine that was on fire. I can't swear to that. I think maybe Bill told me.
Yeah.
But anyway, I would bet money that they find one of the engines is separated. And I would most definitely think it's the left engine that they find, not attached to the airframe. A fire in the air in an aircraft is not something that you want to have to deal with.
Yeah.
There are no little carbon dioxide bottles or fire extinguishers out there. You have one choice. She has to crash it. She has to hit water hard enough to put the fire out, because it's just a matter of minutes before that fire will burn through the wing spar. She'll lose her wing, and then she really goes down without any control at all. So her only choice was to crash the aircraft, period. End of story. She had no other choice if she had an engine on fire.
Yeah. What direction would you like to see this case go from an investigation standpoint? Where should we be placing our resources now in 2022 for this?
In Buka, find out if that's her airplane.
Yeah.
That's the only piece of evidence that it exists in the world today. That's the only piece, concrete piece of evidence that can be traced to her if it is her aircraft. That's
Amen.
It.
Amen to that.
There are serial numbers on the props. There are serial numbers on the engines. There's serial numbers stamped all over the aircraft, not painted, but stamped. Okay. So if we can drag up parts of a ship that was sunk in 1509 or whenever the Spanish treasure fleet sunk, if we can still pull up pieces of that, don't tell me that we can't pull up and identify pieces of an aircraft that went down 85 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I'm sorry, I won't believe you if you want to say that.
Okay. Last question of the night. Let's go back to the beginning of the process for the book. What do you now know that you wish you would have known then?
What I've just discussed. First of all, I wish I'd had all the information about Nikumaroro.
Right.
That thing has been worked to death. Now, Rick Gillespie, and you really have to give him credit, he was able to come up with the financing to completely disprove his theory. Okay.
Oh, I wasn't expecting that.
Sorry, Chris.
That went differently in my mind.
You can investigate something to death, and that is exactly what he's did and what he has done. And he's come up with straws that he grabs at, okay? Mm-hmm. But like I said, he came up with the money to disprove his theory. We have people running around the Pacific Ocean spending millions of dollars mapping the Pacific Ocean 18,000 feet down.
Mm-hmm.
An unbelievable amount of money is being spent there. Logically speaking, I don't discard the crash and sink theory. In fact, I think it's just that's exactly what happened. It did crash and sink, but not near Howland Island.
Yeah.
If you prove that that's her aircraft, like you said in the book, that's not the end of it, because we don't know what really happened. Okay.
Right.
We don't know what happened to her and him. We don't know.
Yeah.
So you're just at square one and a half then, instead of square one.
Yeah.
You have an airplane, you've identified it, you know at least what part of the world the body's in. You have a crime scene now, just like your guy in the book discussed. You have a crime scene and you can find out what happened. I don't know. If it were me and if I had the money, I would be getting the coral off of that wreck, at least on the engine that I believe is detached. It looks like it is. And if it proves to be the right serial number, that's it.
Mm.
You got your crime scene. And then you can go from there. And then you can have a whole new set of podcasts.
Well, you never know. All right, let's get out of here tonight. Where can people get the book? The book is Amelia Earhart Betrayed. Where can people pick it up if they want a copy?
Amazon's good. You can either get it in paperback or you can get it in for Kindle.
All right. We'll have links to the book and some of the things we talked about tonight. Bob, it's a pleasure, as always.
Same here, Chris.
This is Chris Williamson, and thank you for listening to this episode of Chasing Earhart. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each new episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/ChasingEarhart, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @ChasingEarhart. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to Apple Podcasts to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your editor and host for Chasing Earhart is me, Chris Williamson. The show is produced by my wife, Vanessa Williamson, with music by Dane Jarris Schmidt. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Madhouse Films Incorporated. Madhouse Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in the podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Chasing Earhart is an exclusive trademark of Madhouse Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Madhouse Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Chasing Earhart is a Madhouse Films production. Copyright 2022. All rights reserved.